You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live Podcast.
So today's session is going to be a general Q&A on Anthem. You can also ask questions in general about Ayn Rand's philosophy, so we can broaden the discussion, though I'll probably prioritize the questions on Anthem, but happy to do that. So let me just let me stop my screen share and bring in Augustina.
Hi, Aaron.
Hey there. Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right, let me just, I'm locked. So one thing I want to do is I want to share a poll, and this is not the usual poll we run. So let me just pull that up here. There's the poll. But yeah, so the question is, I guess I should launch the poll. That would help. The question is, would you be interested in attending? That's interesting. That's the wrong poll. Are there two polls? Yeah, second poll. There we go. How likely? Here you go. Launch the poll. There we go. Is it coming up? Yeah. So before, now that people are pretty much at home, given the pandemic, we decided to run these reading groups to offer people some online content they consume while they're at home. And we're curious, you know, what you thought of this. Is it the kind of thing you'd read to someone else? Is it the kind of thing that you'd like to see done again in the future? So we'd just like to gather a little information from you guys on that. And I'm curious, and you can post this in the Zoom thing. Is there anyone here today, this is not part of the poll, but is there anyone here today for this session, this bonus Q&A session that we're doing today? This is your first session that you're attending in this Anthem reading group. My guess is probably not, but maybe there's somebody. So just curious about that. So let me minute and let that run, and please answer. Pop up my Q&A thing.
We have two people raising their hand, Juan and Emil. I assume it's because it's their first session.
Okay. All right. So if that's true, welcome to the newcomers. I hope you've read Ayn Rand's novel Anthem. Let's take a look here. So we were sent in, actually, let me pull up the chat too. Here we go. Okay, cool. We were sent in some questions on the Insta page, so we can take live questions if you want to. So to answer the question, so to pose a question, go to the bottom a tray of your Zoom screen where it says Q&A. There's a little Q&A icon. You can click that and you can ask questions there, and we can take a look at them. But just to get this started, did we have some questions on the Insta page where the people were? Augustina?
Was that Aaron? Sorry, you're a little bit choppy.
Do we get questions on the Insta page?
We have a few questions on the Insta page from previous sessions. We can start with one that came in a couple of days ago, and the question is, what inspired Ayn Rand to write the book?
You want to take that one or me?
We can both do it. I can start. I think Ayn Rand, part of the reason I think she wrote Anthem, which she wrote Anthem in, I think, 3 months in between writing The Fountainhead. Part of the reason I think she did it is because, you know, she was born and raised in Soviet Russia, and then she escaped Soviet Russia and came to America. And she was seeing all this totalitarianism rise in Europe, and she came from a very totalitarian state, obviously. And when she arrived here in the United States, she thought that she would see a complete rejection of those ideas, of communism mainly. And she didn't like. She found that she actually saw a lot of intellectuals here in America actually kind of praise communism or tell her, well, you know, you say communism is evil, but it's actually, you don't know that much about it. And she actually did. Of course, she lived it herself. So I think part of the reason that prompted her to write Anthem and write it like so quick, and she wanted to get it out there, is to, you know, sound the alarm on communism and totalitarian regimes. And so she could show people via the novel what these kind of regimes can do to a person's soul.
Yeah, I think that's some of the intellectual motivation for it, in terms of wanting to get a particular set of ideas out there in contrast to what's happening in the culture. And just biographically, Ayn Rand said that she got the idea for this in her school days. So she was a teenager, and she was hearing a lot of attacks on individualism. And she wondered, I wonder what would happen if people lost the word I. And so she had that idea kind of rolling around in her head, so to speak, for some time. And as she was struggling with some difficulties with the plot on The Fountainhead, she just decided to take a summer off, and so to speak, and write that novel. And I think it had some motivational force for her too, just to, I mean, as I always say, I don't know what Ayn would say, probably not, but I would say writing is suffering. When you're really writing and you take your work really seriously, it's a very difficult task. It's a lot of work, a lot of strain, even if you like you're really committed to what you're doing. And I think her view was, I need to see the end product made real, you know, to see the hero kind of succeed and realize my vision in terms of what I wanted to present and project in a simpler form, just so I could get that out and put it out there. And then I'll go back to the work on the much significantly harder novel. Looks like we've got a question here from Aaron. Why are social workers second-handers? So I'll say two things about that. One, it's not true that all social workers are second-handers, but let me say what a second-hander is. So that comes from some terminology that Ayn Rand developed when she was writing The Fountainhead, one of her first really big major novel. And a second-hander is someone who approaches their thinking and their valuing through others, not firsthand through themselves. So it's not somebody who does their own firsthand thinking to figure out what they think is true, what they think is valuable, what they think is important. What they do is they look at other people. What do other people value? What do other people think is true? What do other people think is important? And they let that kind of populate their mind, and they conform to that. So if they approach the world secondhand, not firsthand through their own thinking, but through the thinking of others. And she thought that altruism makes you live life secondhand. So altruism, the idea that you should place the interests of others above yourself, live for others, not for yourself. And that there is a significant amount, because you're saying, well, what are other people's interests, goals, needs, desires, and so on? And let's let that govern my life and what I do. I'll find out what those are and I'll cater to them. But it's not really like thinking about what do I think is important, though, what's important to me. So she thought that there is a strain among social workers where it's they've accepted altruism, and they go into that kind of work because that's what they're motivated by. Here are people suffering, and I'm just going to go do that because that's the moral. Many of them end up really jaded because there's not a lot of reward. I mean, for many people have experienced the idea that there's not a lot of reward, and it's a lot of just unrewarded suffering and pain that you bring home every day. And it's not, and they do it because they think it's moral. But it's not true that they're all second-handers. It's just that's a, like the Katie, the character of Catherine Halsey in The Fountainhead. When you see the way her life takes shape, that's a good example of that. So that was a long-winded answer. Sorry.
Yeah, I would just add, well, you just mentioned that if people want a real, you know, explanation of what second-handers mean and all these issues that Aaron just talked about, The Fountainhead is a book to read.
Yeah, definitely.
And we are actually having a book club as well for The Fountainhead, which starts at 11 Pacific. No, noon Pacific. Well, sorry. Noon, yeah.
Yeah, there's a little hour.
And
yeah.
The recordings are also available in ARI campus if you haven't been following the group.
Okay. Let's take a look here. David asks a question. Has there ever been a discussion within the RAND community, I guess it's the Objectives community, to write a sequel? Well, anybody's free to write whatever they want, but when you get what it would be interesting is if Ayn Rand wanted to write a sequel, but unfortunately she can't. What's better than writing a sequel on this is an author takes up his or her own original idea of what they want to project and see out there in literature, and not make a copy or a sequel or something piggybacking on something that Ayn Rand already did. It's like, let's show us your own achievement. I'd like to see new and original works. Everybody wants a sequel, so to speak. In other words, I mean, if we could have more Ayn Rand novels, that'd be great. And when she was, this was, I guess, what, in the 70s, she was, she finished publishing Atlas Shrugged in 1957. And then turned to writing a lot of nonfiction, philosophical essays, and doing speaking events and so on. But she eventually picked up and started writing another novel, or started writing plans for another novel, outlining, kind of developing characters in her notebooks. It was to be called, the working title was To Lauren Dieterling, and it was supposed to be more lighthearted, is not quite the word, I think, but. Anyway, you can, if you're interested in that, take a look at the Ayn Rand journals that's published. You just look at the Ayn Rand journals, and toward the end, there's a section there on her other fiction work. But unfortunately, she didn't write any more novels. But I will recommend something. There's a book that Dr. Leonard Peikoff put out called The Early Ayn Rand. And if you haven't read this, there's some really good stuff in here. Some of it's just depressing. I found a couple of these stories. Like, I think she was down when she read some of these, or when she wrote some of these. A couple of them are really depressing. But some of them are really lighthearted and fun, like good copy. I always love that. Very early stage in her writing, but that's just an adorable story and really, really benevolent, funny. And then a couple really serious ones, which are really good, like plot-driven stories. Red Pawn. That was written in 1931 to 32. That was her first sale, if I remember right. She sold that script or that story. I don't think anybody did anything with it, but that's a wonderful story. Kind of similar in character to her novel, We the Living. Similar kind of issues. And also there's a couple of plays in here. Ideal, of course, that's in there. And what was the, Think Twice. That's another kind of plot-driven kind of thing. Anyway, there's a lot of really good stuff in here. That's if you've read like The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, and you're unaware of her earlier short stories and stuff, that's a wonderful book. There's also excerpts, unpublished excerpts from The Fountainhead. Scenes and that she decided to remove before she ultimately published it. So it's like director's cut. So there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. So for those of you wanting more Ayn Rand, that's where to go, I would say.
Agree. Okay, we have a question from Anna in the Q&A module. She says, Rand writes, quote, and man will go on, man, not men, close quote. Taking into account that human beings are gregarious, how can this be possible? They have to interact, study, and work together, etc. And conflict is always present, but in some way, they go on together as a species. So what I would say about that is, and I think it's a point we touched on before, Rand is not saying that it's wrong or it's in some way not optimal to live in a society. She thinks there's a lot of value in living in a society, but not in the kind of society where men sacrifice for each other. It's in a society where each man looks for his or her own interest and is able to, you know, is not forced or coerced to produce and to trade with each other. Actually, Rand said that two of the main benefits of living in a society is, you know, trading values and the, you know, the spread of knowledge. So as long as men, as long as people are able to live in a society where there is no, but they don't live for the sake of each other, don't sacrifice each other, it's society is actually a real, real value for men. And, but not as a collective, like humanity in the sense that it's like, you know, the collective humanity that it's each individual person that she cares about.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And also, I think, I mean, so when people talk about individualism today, you often get this idea that we're all isolated little atoms that are all separated in some way, and we shouldn't interact, and that's the notion of what individualism is. But individualism is, it's about every individual having the right to live for his own sake. It doesn't mean you don't cooperate with people. I mean, cooperation and collectivism are not the same thing. To cooperate with others is to join voluntarily on a joint venture or a joint project or association in some way in which both people see advantages, you know, for themselves, and they choose to join or collaborate as they, in terms of their own interests, and they can step out of the collaboration when it's not in their interest. I think that's a good answer. Let's see. Let me go up to
There's a question from Erin. Was Rand an atheist or agnostic? She was an atheist. What I understand agnosticism to be is you don't believe in any particular god or mystical, you know, mythical figure, but you think there is something driving the universe or something like that. But no, Rand was an atheist. She thought, what here, the earth is what we have. We were guided by reason. There's no other realm or God or anything like that. Erin, you're a philosopher, so you would probably be able to address it.
Well, yes, she's an atheist. I put agnosticism a little differently, but people define agnosticism in different ways. Mm-hmm. Often, the way I usually hear it is agnosticism is the view that, you know, I don't know if there's a God or not. And you don't need an ism for that. You might not know what car gets the best gas mileage. You don't need an ism for that. The way I put it is agnosticism is the view that there's no way to know whether there's a God or not. And so what people do, so you can be an agnostic atheist in the sense that your view is there's no reason can't settle the issue. In other words, there's no way to know whether a God exists or not. But I don't buy it. That would be the agnostic atheist. You can be an agnostic theist. In other words, there's no way to know whether there's a God or not, but I believe, like Pascal. An atheist, you can put in two different ways. You can either say it's somebody who has no belief in an existence of a God, which covers even people who've never thought about the issue, you know, or it's an atheist is like, there's a proposition out there that a God exists. And I think it's a false proposition, you know. Ayn Rand is definitely, there's no God. And the reason why is, she says, you need to, when you're trying to figure out what you think is true about the world, about yourself, and so on, you need to follow reason. It's your only tool for figuring things out. It's your only tool by which you can actually reach knowledge. And she says, if you go by reason, there's no argument for the existence of God that actually works. Now you'd have to look into that and think about whether you think that's true. I do. And if you go by faith, there's no way to get to knowledge by faith. If it's just sort of you trust something and hope that it's true, that's you can't reach knowledge like that. I mean, if I have faith that there are nine gods and Augustina has faith that there are three gods, if that's the sole basis for our conclusions, we can't. There's no way to sort out any of this stuff. But if we go by reason, then I expect evidence from her and she expects evidence and arguments from me. And, you know, we have to figure out where the truth lies. If somebody else had posted in the chat, agnostic means you don't take a stand on the issue of whether God exists. Well, as we've said, I mean, there are different ways in which people can kind of characterize what they think of as agnosticism. To not take a stand on the issue I mean, you could formulate it like that, but why wouldn't you take a stand? And it might be, well, because you don't know how to think about it, or you don't know what your view is on it. I think it's an issue someone, you should take a stand on. I mean, it's enormously important, both if it's true and if it's false. But that's it. That's me talking. Do you recommend the Fountainhead movie? I would say, yeah. I mean, I do. I think it's not great, but it's good. And when Ayn Rand was working on this, because she wrote the screenplay for it, so she wrote the script, she thought it was pretty good for what it turned out to be. I think she was unhappy with certain aspects of the... It was a difficult project to bring to fruition, partly with dealing with the, I don't know, the directors, the producers, some of the actors not quite understanding the message. And I think it was very frustrating for her. But I think in the end, I really love the interaction between Patricia Neal, the actress who plays Dominique, and Gary Cooper. I mean, who can't like Gary Cooper? He plays Howard Rourke. Yeah, I thought it was very stylish. But after you've read the novel, of course, that's always the way it is. You just, you fall in love with the novel and it's hard to take the movie. But I actually like the movie.
Yeah, I liked it too. I think it's a good movie. But of course, if you watch it with, you know, expecting to see something similar to what movies are today, that's not the way to watch. You have to take it into context. This is an old-timey movie. It's really also, cinema was way different back then. So it's just a different approach, I think, to film and what we see today, which is, you know, very fast-paced in comparison.
Atlas movies were abomination. that three-volume thing was a complete nightmare. It was a disaster.
Yeah, I did not like it. I watched the first one and then didn't watch any other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Stephanie in the chat question. She says, it, in referring to the Fountain movie, the older Fountain movie, she says, it's such a well-made movie compared to most of the garbage today. Even if you don't think the movies are today are garbage, which I to some extent sympathize with what Stephanie's saying, but it's, yeah, I like black and white movies, kind of the older movies. They're very stylish, I think stylish, dignified. But anyway, that's my view on that. Our view. Let's scroll up to our good friend Isha. So let's see here. Are there any Randian principles that govern our society today? To her moral, what is considered sacred in modern society? Well, this is a bit of a mix in the question here. She prefers the term objectivist to Randian. I remember she was at her first interview, I think, was with Mike Wallace. She said, what is Randianism? And she says, first of all, I don't like that name. that's just a wrinkle. Principles of Ayn Rand's philosophy that govern our society today. No, in the sense of it, nothing explicit. I think to the extent to which there are elements of things that objectivism really takes seriously and they're important aspects of objectivism that are still present in some sense today, is predominantly the result of the founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence and America's history of its respect for individual rights and the whole notion that, I mean, all of this stuff, all of the notions today eroded and has been eroding with some, which is a very sad and worrying fact. But to the extent that one can still expect and appeal to the Declaration with the sense of, like, but this is important. These are foundational principles. I think these are principles, basic notion that every individual has the right to life, own liberty, and the pursuit of his own happiness, and that's the only reason. It's the only legitimizing factor of a government. That's what an individual's right to pursue his own life, his own happiness. To the extent that that still exists in some form, I think you could chalk that one up I mean, that's not coming from Ayn Rand, that's coming from John Locke and the founding fathers, but it's a tradition that she agrees with. And not because it's traditional, because she thinks it's true. What do you see here, Augustina?
We've had this question for a little while that came in a few weeks ago. Why so many different covers for her book?
I think that's mostly a question. Oh, go ahead. I think it's mostly an issue of culture. I think that from time to time, change covers for various reasons. It depends on the agreement that the publisher has with the author, and because there can be back and forth between the publisher and the author in terms of like what she'll approve of, and take a hand in it. They're like, yeah, do publishers do whatever you want. Ayn Rand was interesting because she was quite the businesswoman, so to speak, with her novels, how they were marketed, how they were, what the agreements with the publisher were, what cover art, you know, the little blurbs on the back of the books. She took an active role in mm-hmm. like, this is too, you're trying to make it like a romance story and you're missing the point. And she really was engaged from a business angle on that. I mean, she took the novel really seriously. She wanted to make sure it was marketed in the right way. And if you look through, again, another thing published is Ayn Rand's letters. I mean, they're not all her letters, but it's a kind of a collection of an edited collection of her letters, and you watch back and forth with publishers and so on. She takes a really active role. Somebody's telling me that there's something wrong with my internet connection, and I saw somebody else saying that I was choppy.
Yes, you're choppy.
That's not, I don't know why. I'm wired in here, so I'm not sure, but I guess we'll have to live with that. Apologies to everyone.
We have a question that came in a few days ago too. What kind of moral character or symbol does the Golden One represent? I would say to that she represents the same as equality, which is, you know, the best within man, within the best of humanity, let's say. So Liberty, or the Golden One, she's an independent mind, just like equality, since she has a mind of her own, and she, you know, she refuses to obey these authoritarians or the leaders in her society. And I think that she, like equality, although of course the focus is, like we've said before, the focus is on equality in the book, he's the main character. She ends up having to make also very different and independent decisions than what other people in her society, you know, make. And she ends up, you know, risking her lives and, you know, following equality to the forest. And she does not hesitate to leave. She wants to go with equality and just leave this oppressive society behind. So that's what she represents, like an independent mind, an independent thinker, just like equality.
Yeah. And representing aspects of what Ayn Rand took to be femininity. And with that question, we'll go to David's question about Gaia, which is Liberty's name that Prometheus gives her once they reach the house. The question is, do you have any thoughts on Gaia's inability to take herself away from the mirror? She finds a mirror, for those of you, she finds a mirror in this house and she gets to see herself. Surrounding herself with the trappings of the old world, or Prometheus naming her instead of her naming herself? Yeah, a couple of things. In the story, Equality gets to see himself before she sees herself. So remember, he sees himself in the reflection in a stream, and he's amazed as well, because you're not allowed to see yourself in this society. There are no mirrors. And you're not supposed to know what you look like or care about what you look like, or you just think of yourself, oh, this is me, this is what I look like. You just don't see other people, or your hands or whatever you can see. And he sees himself for the first time, and there's a really cool moment in the story. And check that out. Look at what his view is. And it's a wonderful passage, I think, because I remember he said, Equality said something like, He talks about how he looks different than some of the other people in terms of, but there's one thing is he said, we felt like we could trust this person. Mm-hmm. And it's like there seems that something of honesty and integrity that he can kind of, like that looks like somebody I could trust, but he's never seen himself. The idea about Gaia in the mirror, well, I think the idea is she's beautiful and she's maybe never seen anybody that looks like this before. And this is her first experience of seeing herself in a mirror and she's amazed by it. I don't think the takeaway there is, girls are all about looking at themselves in the mirror and putting on jewelry, dressing up dolls. I don't think that's the thing. I think it's she's amazed and really struck by what she sees. And I think it's a wonderful experience. And also, I mean, they live in, they wear some kind of a tunic. There's no jewelry. There's no adornment. There's no other aspects of beauty that you might bring into your life. And she's finding these jewelry and it's just like, this is amazing, So,
In her society, in Anthem society, there's no, like you said, there's nothing other than, just plain clothes, and there's no way in which they can express their personality through material objects. And now she sees all these beautiful objects surrounding her, and she sees herself, which she hasn't before, like you said, and that's fascinating to her.
Yeah, and then
in 17 years, she hadn't seen her own face, basically.
Yeah, and then when she finds the closet, there's not like one tunic
mm-hmm.
or two tunics for laundry day. There's a whole variety of outfits, and that's mind-blowing too. So people can wear different things on different days, and it's just she's going through some of the things. Let's see here.
There's a question by Steve, and you have written quite a bit about this, Aaron. So the question is, Rand's concept of what it means to be selfish and selfless is totally at odds with how these words are used in our culture. We always have to clarify that when Rand advocates is not the common view. I mean, the her view of selfish is not the common view. Would it be better to use rational self-interest to get across Rand's concept instead of selfish and selfless?
Well, I use the terms interchangeably. I mean, Rand sometimes says selfishness, sometimes rational selfishness, sometimes rational self-interest, sometimes egoism. But she's deliberately choosing to use the term selfishness. I mean, she doesn't always use that particular term, but she's choosing the word selfishness because she's trying to decouple. She's trying to, because if you use that word, obviously that triggers all sorts of associations of, evil and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But what she's trying to do is break our association between the pursuit of one's own interests and evil, the pursuit of one's own interests and disregard for others, the pursuit of one's own interest and trampling over others to get whatever the hell you want, right? She's trying to say our culture has fused those together. And so we can't really think of a self-interested person who's not also a thoughtless jerk or worse. And it's hard to think with that sort of notion. And so what you have to do is you have to peel off or break off the moral evaluation of built into what it means to be a self-interested person. And because you can say, what does it mean? So what does it mean to pursue one's own interests? What are one's own interests? So that's that's a morally neutral question. So she feels like the definition of selfishness, which goes to the dictionary definition. I don't think she means that. That's what's in the dictionary. I mean, this is like a neutral statement of what it is. It's the pursuit of one's own interest. And the fact that has been coupled with a very negative view. Well, it's been coupled with a certain view of what is in your interest. And that's, I trample you to get whatever I want. And then, of course, the moral evaluation, that's bad. And they package that into one unit. So you have to break that up. But let me address the question. Why didn't she just pick a different word that's not so triggering? Doesn't have all this connotation and baggage. I think in the end, it's suppose you just decided to call it rational self-interest and the view you were advocating is Ayn Rand's ethics, I think you're still going to get the pushback because they're going to say, yeah, oh, so you just mean selfishness. Yeah. Oh, you mean just live for yourself, and then you're going to have the same sort of problems. But I think she's deliberately picking a fight by using the term, and because she thinks it's something you really need to shake people up about. I mean, if you tell somebody that I think selfishness is more, it's like, whoa, I mean, that, you get the conversation started. But
yes, definitely.
Do you have records? So this is one from Steve. Another one. Let's come back to Steve. Aaron asks a question. What are the issues that objectivism has with the current U.S. economic and political culture right now? Well, if by issues, we got issues. If you mean by issues, you mean the problems that objectivism sees with the current U.S. economic and political culture right now. Well, it's fundamentally it's becoming more collectivistic. It's becoming more statist. And less individualistic, less respect for individual rights, more increasing role of government telling people what they can do and can't do in their lives, less choice for the individual, less freedom for the individual, whether you're in business or not, more government control over the economy. It's moving more in the direction of collectivism and statism, you know, and it's been doing that since, you know, at least the 30s, the 1930s.
If you look at the two most prominent, you know, political parties in America, they seem to be opposites, or they pretend to be opposites in a sense, but they're actually just equally collectivistic. And so there's no real individualistic perspective out there. In the mainstream, I mean, you know.
Yeah, because you have two welfare statist parties, and one has a little different emphasis on different kinds of values, and another one has a different sense of emphasis. But you can argue about which you think is worse for the country, and that goes on, and on. Let's see here. Caitlin asked, why do the people of the society in Anthem, how come they don't live to a very long age? I believe 40 was considered a long time. Yeah, well, they live without technology.
Mm-hmm. They live without science, too. Yeah. Science and technology. So it's only expected that they would live until, you know, just die very young.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, our life expectancy a century ago, so was really low as well. And, you know, as science advances, we get treatments for diseases and just, you know, more medical advances that allow us to live much longer. But then, there was nothing like that in
yeah. And without that, society. They live by physical labor. You know, where it's like sun up to sun down. You're engaged in physical labor. When the sun goes down, unless you have candles, you work in the dark, straining your eyes. Whether you're sewing something or making shoes or whatever it is that you're doing. I mean, it's a rough life. Let's see here.
Caitlin asks, on page 96, the second indented paragraph, why does Prometheus still call the people of the society his brothers? I think there might be two possible answers here, and Aaron, you tell me which, or if you have a third answer. I think probably who he's referring to is the people that have shown some sort of will to think independently, or have at some point thought independently, like his friend International, who, you know, kept his secret about the tunnel, and they had actually developed friendship. I think he's referring to or the character that, you know, that screams at night in terror because he cannot take this society, this oppressive regime. I think he's referring to those people, and those would be the only people that would be willing to go with him to start, you know, this new society. And the other answer could be, I think he understands now that all people are capable of thinking independent, are capable of using reason. Of course, choosing to use reason or not, it's actually a choice. But I think he might be recognizing the fact that they all can become what he has become.
I'll add, I think he's definitely talking about the people he respects more, but I think it's even broader. Two things. One is, he says, I mean, the paragraphs you're referring to, he says, I owe nothing to my brothers, nor do I gather debts from them. I ask none to live for me, nor do I live for any others. I covet no man's soul, nor is my soul theirs to covet. I'm neither friend nor foe to my brothers, but such as each of them shall deserve of me, et cetera, et cetera. I think he means people more generally. Notice that you don't get expressions from equality of contempt for his fellow citizen or whatever you want to call the people in the society. I think he pities them. I mean, so he becomes friends or closer to the people he respects more. And they seem to show some kind of independence, and he feels a bond with them, and he feels closer to them. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also that it's anybody in the society who shows that if he's deserving of love, or if he's deserving of friendship, or if he's deserving of respect as an individual, then he will show love or friendship or respect. I think he means this, quite generally. But certainly, and much more so, the people that he's come to actually respect in the novel. let's see, I'm going to skip it. Aaron asked a question, what do you think of the book Urantia? I've never read it, so.
I haven't either.
No comments.
Caitlin asks, if it weren't for Prometheus, would Gaia still have been an individual and be independent? I think the answer is yes. She was independent before. She was an independent thinker before she met him. That's why she's the one that initiates contact with him, and she's the one that is willing to keep that forbidden type of relationship with him. It's not that she, because there's no way she could have initiated that and kept it on going if she had only started thinking independently and pursuing her own values in a way as much as she could, if she hadn't been like that before meeting him.
And another thing, you can't make someone independent. So it's not like if Prometheus really had some, he did something that would make her an independent person, the type of person who thinks for themselves, forms their own values, and so on. You can't make somebody like that. So, I mean, it's the fact that both of them are already like that they have this sort of bond that they feel.
I think she was, Caitlin was also asking, because it could be the case that Equality or Prometheus showed her this alternative, and she actually kind of was. In reality, I think she was actually, discovering it herself.
Yeah, I mean, because also she's discovering, so one of the things Equality's done is he's actually gone and broken the rules already. He's already taken independent action in the way he's found the tunnel. He's doing his own experiments. He sneaks out of the tent every night, where they're holding those propagandistic plays or whichever. So he's already experiencing himself as living more independently already, whereas she's not actually experiencing that, but she's the type of person who wants that and who loves that. Yeah. Let's see here.
David has a question. Do you suggest teaching this book in conjunction with any other literature?
Well, I'm not a literature teacher, so how exactly you'd construct a unit with this, if you're like this among other stories? I mean, it's commonly put together with other dystopian literature, things like 1984 and Fahrenheit 450. What is it? 451?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the number. Brave New World, things like that. I tried reading Brave New World, but I thought it was really boring. Sorry. I'm triggering people. Yeah, so I haven't thought a lot about that, except what things I would contrast that with. If I were teaching it, I'd have to think about exactly what I would do. I would probably not do that, but that's a common way to do it because, you know, when literature teachers are trying to introduce people both to a genre, like a sort of type of literature, like dystopian literature, it's common to see commonalities between the two so that the students can integrate, oh, okay, I can see this, it's that type of literature and these are the differences and stuff. So that's I'm sure that's effective from a pedagogical perspective. Question from Jihoon, if I'm pronouncing your name right. If I'm not, apologies. Did Rand perceive religious groups and societies as akin to collectivism or cooperation? This can go both ways. It depends on the extent to which the religious groups and societies one belongs to demand or expect or require some sort of subordination of the individual to the group, some sort of subordination of your judgment, like you're just supposed to believe, you're just supposed to obey, you're just supposed to engage in these rituals. Why? That's what we do. Our society does this, and you're going to be on the outs with the society if you don't do it. And so you're supposed to comply. It's about obedience, compliance, not about your understanding of what the truth is. I'm an atheist, but I grew up in a religious home. We went to church on Sundays and so on. I mean, everybody was really nice to me. I didn't get jaded from religion because people were mean. The people of my church were really nice. I had no issue with that. I mean, I dropped it at age 11, but it was, nonetheless, it was, as I grew up, though, if I'm getting 15, 16, 17, I'm becoming more able to really think for myself, and I'm sitting in that room, like, why am I here? That was a question I asked all the time. I get 2 days off of school, Saturday, Sunday, and one of them I'm wasting here, like, blowing my day, and then I got to go home, do chores, I got to mow the lawn, and so it's like, why am I wasting time here? And I guess that's what I get. It was the why questions. Because what's what people do on Sundays? You go to church and everybody does it. You know, everybody gets in their car and dresses up. And I think it was the compliance that I couldn't stand. I mean, early on, it was just, you're just supposed to do it, you know, and I don't accept anything like that. Somebody tells me you're just supposed to, that's not an argument.
I was raised Catholic too, although not very strict, but I went to a Catholic high school.
You got kicked out of Catholic.
I got kicked out of Catholic high school because I just was asking a lot of questions that they did not like. I was actually an okay student at that point, but I was, you know, asking things that were too uncomfortable for them to take. And the fact that they cannot, you know, tolerate, not even dissent, because I wasn't dissenting, I was just asking. I just wanted to know. And that fact I've encountered, not just in that school, but it's a common theme in at least, you know, Christianity or Catholicism. It's basically everywhere. You cannot question. This is, you know, this text is the authority. And there's no question in it.
And I could not take that in that regard. So let me ask a question, or answer a question from Caitlin. Caitlin, you're peppering us with questions. That's good. Why does equality give names to liberty twice? First, he calls her the golden one, and second, he calls her Gaia. There's an answer to that one. So in the first case where they meet each other, I think for the first or some maybe second time, I think, Liberty tells equality, we have a name that we made up, or I have a name that I hold in my own head for you. I don't call you equality, whatever. I think of you as the unconquered. And then equality says, we don't also think of you as, Liberty 5-3000. We think of you as the golden one. So they both come up with names independently for each other for the first time. But the second time, the name, the reason why he comes up with a name for her second is because it's coming through his reading. So he's been reading lots of books that are at the house that they discovered, you know, once they escaped the forest. And he's reading about history. And he's reading about things like history, mythological figures. I mean, he's reading of just absorbing and consuming a lot of the stuff. And he finds that there are these characters that, in a way, there's a way in which he thinks of them as representative of them. So he names himself, because he wants to choose his own name. And he calls himself Prometheus, the one who stole the fire from the gods, like the light and the fire that can light men's lives and stuff. And he was tortured for it. And he said, that's like me. This is like what happened to me. You know, I'll take on that name proudly. And he finds another name for another character, and which he gives to Liberty, or whatever you call it, Golden One, which she accepts. So I think the reason why there's a second time is because it's coming out of his reading, and some of his thinking about. I mean, because again, they're going to have a family there, and Gaia is in a way it's the starting point of a new generation of people. And
we have.
Caitlin asked a question, which I'm going to deflect on, but there's a reason for this. She says, "Do you think the philosophy objectivism has any flaws?" I mean, I can answer that, but I don't think it's very helpful, my answer. To the extent that I understand, and I think that to the extent that I think that I understand and I've got the right view about her philosophy and what it is, in my view, I don't think so. And I know that sounds weird, because if somebody says, oh, so you don't agree with me, you agree with absolutely everything, it sounds like that's kind of hard to believe. But a philosophy is an integrated system. And when you get the principles, and you have to think about this, you certainly don't take my word for it. My word shouldn't mean much here. But if you get the principles right at a deep level, I think it's easier to work out a lot of the rest. But I mean, it's, so I can answer that, but it's not very helpful, because it you'd have to look into it. I mean, so I'll say this one more thing is, when I started studying philosophy, I had this experience where you'd read a little Plato or something. I agree with this, and then you start, but that's obviously wrong. That doesn't make any sense. Or you, this is right, but I don't buy that. And that was my experience reading other thinkers. And it was not my experience reading Feynman. And what I had to grapple with is not understanding a lot of this stuff, or thinking I understood it and then realizing, no, I don't really understand it that well. So this has been a process. I mean, I'm in my 40s, and I discovered Ayn Rand, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So I've been spending a lot of time with it and thinking about it. But again, that's just something you have to take take a really first-handed perspective on it. It's like, what do I think her philosophy is? What does she stand for? Do I think I understand that? And how does that measure up with what I can see in my own life and what I can see in the own? She's telling me such and such about other people. Has this been my experience with other people? What's the evidence that she provides? Well, whether it's in the novels or in her nonfiction work, what is the evidence that she puts forward to, you know, give me reasons to think this is true? And that's a bit of a journey. But that's how you evaluate, well, basically anything, whether it's a philosophy or a scientific theory. I mean, you have to look at what is the facts and evidence that would support the conclusion.
Yeah, I agree with that. I didn't study philosophy, I studied law, but when I was a teenager, I started reading philosophy, and I read quite a few authors from, you know, tried to read Kant, did not succeed. It was very difficult. But, you know, from Nietzsche to Nozick, and when I got to Rand, I found her much more convincing because of the evidence she presented, and she just made sense. It's very logical. And when you realize that one premise follows the other, and it's pretty, in a sense, flawless. I mean, the logic is there. So you can actually see it. It's very evident to you, and you don't have to, you know, be a philosopher or an expert to realize that. So I found Rand to be much more convincing than other authors I've read.
So we only have a few minutes. Let's go fast.
Yeah, I wanted to address real quick at least a few questions about the essay contest.
Okay.
So we had a few come in to the Insta page throughout the weeks that we've been holding these sessions. So
are these the ones about grading?
Yes, grading and you know, length of the essays.
Keith and I answered those in an earlier session.
Okay. But for people that want to get more information on the essay contest, they can Google Ayn Rand Institute Anthem Essay Contest, and you will find our page there. And I will paste the link here in the chat for anyone that wants to check it out. And we also have essay contest for the Fountainhead Natural Shrug. So it's not just Anthem.
Yeah, and if you're a teacher attending this, it's if you're assigning the novels in the class and if they're doing the essay contest, I'd recommend sending us. I mean, if you're having them send it in for the contest, send in the best essays. In your view as a teacher, what you think are your top essays, send those in. That would be great. A couple of questions. Anna asks a question. I think it's I definitely want to answer this. I'll shorten it. He said, equality is glad that the golden one hasn't been sent to those reproduction chambers, you know, where they turn 18, they're supposed to reproduce. Would he see her the same way if she had been brought there for that purpose? Would he value her for what she is independently from those, quote, virgin, pure prejudices? Absolutely. I think he would regard her as a victim. He's angry about it because to think that she'd be put through that. And his feelings for her are so strong. I mean, just think about someone you love or a daughter or something that just gets stuck in, you know. But he would view her absolutely as a victim. It's not that she sort of tainted goods or something like that. I mean, I think that would be incredibly unjust.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been a choice she made. She would have been forced to do it. It's not like she chose to engage with, you know, a stranger or by her own, you know, will. It's just she would have been forced to do that.
Steve asked the question, outside of objectivists, are there other current intellectuals whom ARI considers somewhat close to being rational, like Steven Pinker, Sam Harris, Dave Rubin? Well, I'm not going to speak for ARI having a view on these people, but do I think that are there other intellectuals who have something to bring to the table? Certainly. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in Steven Pinker. Sam Harris does some things very well. Other things, I think, in my view, not well. But, you know, I think it's good to pay attention to other intellectuals in the culture who bring something rational to the table. And it doesn't pay off to, oh, they're not objectivists, so we don't listen to them. Often they bring a lot of expertise to some area and some real clear thinking. There are other good minds out there, even if they don't have a philosophic system that you think is right, ultimately. Like, I think Harris is good on religion. And on issues in Islam and so on. I think he's written some really good stuff there. Less good on the issue of free will and determinism. I mean, so it's, and also less good on certain aspects of moral philosophy. But, you know, you have to read everyone critically, including Ayn Rand, including Steven Pinker, including other people. And, you know, you have to sort out what you think is true and valuable and what isn't. But, I mean, that's not an ARI's perspective per se, but yeah.
Okay, Aaron, so we're at time. Is there anything else you would like to share?
Can we just keep going? I wish we could. So let me do this. So let me remind everyone. So let me share my screen here for a second. Which one do I want to share? Sorry, I always do this a little ineptly. Just reminding everybody, is that sharing, Augustina?
Yes.
Cool. Reminding everybody about the Fountainhead discussion group that we've got going on that occurs an hour after this is done. One other thing, we have ARI's YouTube channel has now breached the 50,000 subscriber gap, which I think is pretty cool. So if you're interested in more content coming from the Institute, go ahead and get on and click subscribe to get the numbers up. That helps us out. And now that everybody's got these smart TVs and you can screen them, I watch the videos on my TV because I got a big screen TV, and I try to catch up on things that I missed there. So if you're interested in that, please do it. Help us out. And I guess that is it. So that's it for the, this is sad. So this is the end of the Anthem reading group session. I just want to say thanks to everyone. Again, more questions than we could answer. So thanks for sending all those in. If you're interested in us doing more of these kinds of things, perhaps more regularly, perhaps on a different novel, just let us know. Send us in your feedback. Let us know what you think. And if you really like the sessions, let us know. It's always good to hear feedback. And if you thought the things that we could improve, send us that too. And thanks for joining me, Augustina.
Thank you, Aaron. And thanks, everyone, for joining us well for these few weeks that we've had this group. And stay healthy.
Yeah.
And hope to see you again soon.
You've been listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast is made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to aynrand.org/membership.